The following episode may contain explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. Back to the Atlanta podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis. We are off in 2019 and running and loving it. I'm recording at RCR Studios every Tuesday now, which is fantastic, which means I can bring you new episodes constantly as I've scheduled a bunch of great talent. RCR Studios, love Randall and Ray and the team over there. They will help you make great content. If you are looking for a video producing team, that is your team. Want to read the latest iTunes review from PixieGirl123. She gave us 5 stars. I loved how Matt is so open with his guests. He got into topics that explore the artist as a person rather than just their music, which can be difficult to do. I listened to some of Pip's music, and I think her shows would be interesting to see. Great questions and great guests. Thank you so much, PixieGirl123. Really happy you liked the show and that we turned an artist on to you. As you know, the tagline for this show, or maybe you don't know, the tagline for this program is, I talk to the famous, Atlanta famous, infamous, and anyone else I find interesting. So that's who you're going to get on this program. And Pip was someone that looked fascinating to me, and I've since been listening to her music. I highly recommend getting the stuff on the iTunes. It's free. And then, yeah, follow her stuff, become a Patreon of hers, you know, whatever. Pixie Girl, thank you so much. You too can have your review read on the air. Go to that Purple Podcast app, drop a review. We'd love to hear from you. Or Spotify. We're on the Spotify? Are we on the Spotify? I don't know. I got to figure that shit out. But wherever you're enjoying the program, let us know. And specifically you, PixieGirl123, would love to hear how you found us. Were you referred by a friend? Did you Google podcasts about Atlanta? Are you listening to another Atlanta podcast? And on the bottom, it says listeners also liked. Always like to find out how people find about us. We're also on Instagram at ATL Podcast, and I'm personally available on pretty much all the platforms as Matt B. Davis. On today's program, Tommy Howsworth. Now, Tommy is a friend of mine and has been for a few years. And while many of my friends are quite interesting, Tommy's a guy who's had an interesting career path, a guy who has put his creative juices to work successfully for many years. And I think there's a lot to learn there. And I think it's just a cool story. And as you know, I'm not one who's going to list somebody's bio in the intro because that's what you're about to find out about. So let's dig in. Tommy and I were on my front porch, and then I believe it was chilly. We moved inside to the old couch. A nice hour-long chat, so enjoy your run or workout or laundry or dog walk. Away we go. Larry King always says, I want to find out as the audience is finding out. Why do I ever want to know anything ahead of time? I would never read your book ahead of time. I want to ask general questions. And Ira Glass prepares 1,000 questions.
Right.
And they might use one. He might interview 100 people in a town and use one. And Terry Gross said, when I'm interviewing you, like, she'll read the book. She'll do massive research on your career. Mm-hmm. Robert, if she's talking to Robert De Niro or whatever.
Yeah.
And then she's like, I have an A track, a B track. I mean, whoa, right? But here's the, and you know, Maron, as we know, just wings it. And Larry King clearly wings it. So the point is there's no right way.
Like no right way. However, I will say every time I listen to Terry Gross, I am amazed at how deep she goes. And she'll be talking to Wynton Marsalis one day and Kendrick Lamar the next, and she right. knows as much about each of them. Larry King, you've seen that scene where he got nailed by Seinfeld, right? It's history. It's absolute history.
I'm sure I have, but please refresh my memory.
I think the B movie was coming out at the time, so Seinfeld's plugging it. And Larry King goes, so Seinfeld, 9 seasons. Now you ended it. They didn't cancel you. And I mean, Seinfeld's a bit of a jerk.
He can be. I've noticed. But he was like, but I like that about Seinfeld a little bit.
I do too. I don't mind it because he backs it up, but
right.
he was like, Larry, 79 million viewers. They canceled me? So he wouldn't let it go. Oh. It's like that Sam Jackson interview where the guy accidentally thinks he's Lawrence Fishburne.
Oh, boy.
And Sam Jackson just will not let the guy off the hook. It's like, you think we all look alike? Is that what you're saying? No, I'm the, you know, what's in your wallet guy. He's...
I want to see that.
Oh, I just need to send you a link to...
It's
a Watch Mojo.
I only recently, I want to say in the last 2 years, saw the Grapes Lady. And apparently that was like the...
The grape stomping lady who fell and made that horrible noise?
And one of the things that's done is, right here, these buckets are filled with grapes. What kind of grapes?
These are filled with Chamberson grapes, and the winner this Saturday who stomps the most juice will actually win an overnight stay here at Chateau Alon.
You ready?
You ready to try it?
Yeah, sure.
Let's go.
Not disgusting.
Let's
All right,
go.
You ready? Give us a 30-second time. Here we go. So what's the deal here? There's a contest to stomp, and how are you measuring who does the best stomping?
And whoever stomps the most juice wins an overnight stay, but it's not the only thing you can do.
The measuring cups are down below, right?
Measuring cups are down below.
All right. And if you win, you get to stay at Chateau Alon, and what else do you have going on here?
Well, if grape stomping's not your thing, you can come and spend the day listening to live music, eating international foods, having wine tours and tastings, vineyard tours, seminars, arts and crafts. It's a lot of fun, a whole day.
Stop.
Oh, no. Oh, dear.
I think she's actually hurt.
No,
there.
I think she is.
Yeah, she's Ouch. Hurt. She took a hard fall off there.
Okay. Boy,
gosh, I hope she's okay.
Okay. Mm. We're going to make sure she is.
We'll try and check on her and get back to you as soon as we can.
We'll be back right after this.
I hadn't seen it.
That was local. That was Georgia.
I hadn't actually get her on the podcast. I hadn't seen that.
And she can still talk and walk. I hadn't seen that.
And my friend Dario, who's probably listening to this, sent me that. He's like, I can't believe you hadn't sent me that. And then he sent me a handful I hadn't seen. Clearly, I've seen We'll Do It Live. But I also hadn't seen Those People Are So Poor and So Black. Do you know that one? I haven't seen that one. That's Wolf Blitzer during Hurricane Katrina. So that's a good one. But the new Do It Live guy, do you know that one? Stop with the hammering!
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Good one. Classic. Anyhow, so... But see, here's what's fascinating to me. So are you watching Comedians in Cars?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's what's fascinating about Seinfeld is he's... First of all, for the comedians out there, like, we have so much respect for him, right? Such a machine, mm-hmm. such a joke-writing machine, and clean, and quality, and meticulous, yeah. and, you know, I've talked to people who knew him back in the day, and said literally he would leave the bar at, like, 11, even like some girl's talking, like, hey, I gotta write, I've written today, like, but he isn't the self-hating, you know, you must have issues comic, and he says that, he's like, I don't believe that for a second, why is that such a thing? Now, Did you see Letterman's thing with him recently?
Not sure. Doesn't ring a bell. No.
So, you know, Letterman's got a new show?
Yes.
My next guest?
Yes.
So Seinfeld does that, and that kind of comes up. And so then the next question is, like, but why are so few like you? You seem to be, like, a well-adjusted, normal, parents-loved-him guy.
Right.
Like, you're
the exception.
You know you're the exception, so what do you think you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're not Louis C.K. or Richard Lewis, there's the whole, like, I'm going to bring my issues to the stage.
Right.
I mean, he's more of a, like, you know, again, sort of the last observational comedian.
Right. But does art have to come from pain, I think, is the question, right?
That can be the question, yes. I mean, he never puts his pain out on stage. I mean, I never leave watching Seinfeld stand up feeling like I know more about him. In fact, that's part of his weaponry, is not to let you into that part of who he is.
Right. And all the good comics, the greatest comics, would say when they found their voices, when they were finally willing to stop talking about, you know, the sock and the laundry and to talk about what's real.
Look at George Carlin. I mean, he used to wear a suit and go on, you know, Ed Sullivan. And
right.
It was horrible because it was,
Well, he was funny at the time and he was good enough to get booked on Ed Sullivan.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying, but almost
it was
any
because it wasn't him.
But pretty much just any comic that you like or respect, or anyway, that I do, sort of say that, like, you know, like, I didn't... So your experience as a writer, right? Yeah. Which we're going to talk about.
Sure.
That's sort of where where I was coming from with that, like, good
stuff. Does my writing come from pain?
Does the good stuff, do you have to have the... Because people say that, too, about, like, if I stop smoking pot, I won't be creative anymore. Right?
Right.
Or if I go to therapy, I won't be this miserable person
anymore.
Yeah,
you're afraid you're going to kill the dragon, and with that comes...
Right, so...
You know, I mean, I...
So I'll do Larry King. Tommy Osworth, your thoughts, depression, anxiety. That's Bill... Oh my God, what's his name? God rest his soul. Phil Hartman doing
Larry King.
Right.
Or, yeah.
Cleveland, Ohio.
You're next. I certainly think a lot of great art comes from some internal suffering, but I also thought that there was a great analogy in the Ken Burns jazz documentary where, and it was Branford Winton, it was Cassandra Wilson who said it. She was like, yeah, Charlie Parker had a miserable life. You know, he would hawk his horn to shoot up heroin,
mm-hmm.
and then to get his horn back from a gig long enough to play and then take it back again. It's like, he did that so I don't have to. He showed me what the art can be, and I've learned the lessons from the mistakes he made. I'm not going down that road. I'm going to take care of my instrument and see where it takes me. So I think there are, you know, again, to use Seinfeld as an example, I can't tell you who in Hollywood hasn't gone down the trail of tears at some point, but I think we have a certain admiration for those that have remained somewhat well-adjusted. I mean, you knew this example would come up eventually. I didn't know until his autobiography came out that Springsteen dealt with depression. And I'm a huge Springsteen fan, but what he puts out there for everybody is well-adjusted alpha male. And by well-adjusted, I mean I don't use my powers for harm. I, you know, appear on stage giving you everything, and I believe in what I'm saying. And when I walk out of here, I'm going to go have a hamburger and go home to my loving family. And you find out, oh no, he was not. He was going home and turning out the light.
Did you hear the Maron interview with him?
Yeah.
So Maron read the book.
Yeah.
And then asked, and then great job, by the way, because Maron wasn't a Bruce guy.
Right.
And so I think he navigated that really well, because he still, for not a Bruce guy, he covered, you know, some of the music without going like album by album. And
well, I think what he gave us in that interview was, whether you're a Bruce guy or not, we all know Born to Run, Born in the USA, the band reunited in 2000, The Rising.
Right.
Take us somewhere we haven't been. And I'm sure for Springsteen's sake, like, let's talk about my upbringing. Let's talk about my schizophrenic dad. Let's talk about the fact
that... But he didn't know that going into it, that he's going to be willing to go there.
No. I would imagine not. But I think, you know, to go back to the question of... I think great art can come from a sense of stability and sobriety, and then I think it can also come from, you know, the other side of that, the fear, the anxiety. It comes from all places. I think a lot of the comedy I enjoy most comes from somebody sharing who they are, and whether that's Patton Oswalt, who would get on stage months after his wife died unexpectedly and share that grief in a way that allowed us to laugh a little bit and help him heal, and he helped us be okay with the fact he was up there. Or like a guy like John Mulaney, who I don't think is necessarily laying out any kind of current crisis.
Right.
But he's like, yeah, I used to drink until I was absolutely unconscious, and then I would go out with my wallet and do bad things.
Right.
You know?
I haven't seen Mulaney, so.
Mulaney's great.
Yeah.
He looks like he's like 12.
I saw that recent Patton special.
Yeah.
It was really
Annihilation,
good.
Annihilation, yeah.
And I'm not the biggest Patton fan, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when Patton... So Patton came from that first school of alternative comics. I'm doing air quotes. Love when I do air quotes on a podcast. So him, Gene Garofalo, Brian Posehn, like all those
Maria
guys.
Bamford. Zach. Yeah.
Not Bamford, though, and not Zach. They're on their own planets. But all those other folks, they just had this... It was just this very, like, self-righteous, I'm not going to be a standard comic.
Yeah.
I'm going to be sort of this other thing. I'm not... What about
airplane food?
Right. And so they were a little self-important, and sometimes I feel like they would just like spend 20 minutes on stage saying nothing. But I think, and I kind of hold that against Patton, but I think I feel like, or just like, hey guys, isn't Bush a moron? You know, just right.
Yeah, sure, softballs that are easy to hit.
But I feel like that I enjoyed that one.
But I think what I like about him is I do sense that he's being genuine and vulnerable. I don't think that the person who walks off that stage is somebody else in his hotel room. I think that he's who he seems to be, which is about all I ask of any artist is show me who you really are.
Right.
And if part of that is being a jerk, then treat other people with respect and maintaining your jerkhood.
Yeah, well, you know, spoiler alert, you know, he talks about his losing his wife, but he did that weird crowd work segment before.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of watching it going, well, why is he doing this? This is a special, right? You know, crowd work is kind of what you do to sort of like kill time or to get yourself out of a jam because the joke's not working. And then he just said it, and he said it almost like under, just sort of like under passive, whatever the phrase I'm trying to think of.
Yeah, passive, aggressively, almost.
Well, he just said in passing,
I'm
dragging this out because I got to get to this next part, which is really hard for me.
Right.
And then it was like, oh, like, okay, like he can't just go, joke, 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 my wife's dead. He's got to like lay us into it, and how he's going to do that, set himself up, is to just kind of fuck around and talk to the crowd. That made, again, as a comic, that made me appreciate it. I don't know if people give a shit about that or not, but it made a difference to me.
Well, what people, I've learned in teaching non-comedians to do comedy, accountants to do comedy specifically.
They're a fun bunch.
Yeah, they're actually pretty funny, some of them.
Right.
People don't have an appreciation for just your general audience walking in to see a comedy show. I'm not sure that there's an understanding of what a high wire act it is and what happens if you fall, because it's not you just had a bad set. It's really a reevaluation of your entire career and life every night when you walk off that stage. And I imagine it's the same way for musicians and everyone else. But with music, there's a certain appreciation of the technique and artistry. It's like you played the guitar well, you hit all the right notes, your music just doesn't move me. Versus comedy, it's reflexive. I mean, I think George Carlin said laughter is the only emotive response we can get from somebody, both physically and non-physically. You can tickle someone to make them laugh, or you can say something that instigates scales of laughter. And the more I thought about that, I'm like, well, no, you can make people cry by saying something or hitting them. But his point is, laughter is such an involuntary thing, we can't put our finger on why it happens to us.
Right.
So when we leave a comedy show feeling unfulfilled, we're like, I don't know, it was just something, it just wasn't funny. So, I mean, again, you're putting you up there when you're... If you're Bob Hope, I guess you're not putting you up there because you're just doing quick little one-liners, but the confessional comedy of the 21st century and the late 20th century is about, like, here's my open wounds.
Right. Please. I don't know. I want to think that Jack Benny and Bob Hope, like, had rough nights and took it personally. And...
Sure they did. But they had the chance to refine material in a way that I'm not sure... I mean, you used to be able to, like, pretty much do the comedy circuit for a year and a half on 45 minutes of material.
Sure.
And now you do one special on TV and you're like, well, got to start over.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how Chappelle keeps coming out with stuff. I'm really wondering if he's taking the stage with an hour's worth of material. He's like, I got 20 minutes, the rest I'll just riff.
It feels like it. I mean, he's amazing.
Now, you talk about what... I saw him a couple of weeks ago at the Tabernacle. He and Jon Stewart.
Right.
And his set feels very loose. Sometimes sloppily loose, but you're okay with it because it's sort of like, oh, I came to see Prince and he's not sure what song he's playing next,
right,
but it's Prince.
Right.
But somebody actually posted, it's the anniversary of, here I'm going to take a hard downhill turn, anniversary of Emmett Till's death.
Who's that?
He was the young man who, he was 14, it was pre-civil rights era, young African-American young man. He supposedly catcalled at a white woman and was brutally murdered,
right,
tortured and murdered. His mom decided it, against all logic in terms of the grief she was going through, to have an open casket funeral.
Right.
Every magazine in America, every newspaper picked up the picture of that poor young man.
Right.
And it changed the civil rights movement. I mean, it made people go, okay, we got to do something. Chappelle did a bit in the middle of his show about it. Someone posted it today, and I was like, okay, what did Dave Chappelle have to say about this? That he took an audience from, you know, laughing about living in Ohio and being an African-American man, going to the hardware store or whatever, to suddenly, like, civil rights 14-year-old boy murdered. And then the woman who accused him on her deathbed said, actually, most of that didn't happen. So he took something that felt like a powder keg to me. And I don't feel like he had a prepared script. I felt like he was like, I'm going to talk about Emmett Till for a couple of minutes because it's important.
Right.
But I haven't scripted this material the way Jerry Seinfeld talks about working a line and working a line and working it until it's perfect. And I fall somewhere in between my notion of how comedy should perhaps be done. I guess if you're Dave Chappelle and you feel like you can just pull it out. Seinfeld, I don't think...
Well, I think Chappelle and, let's say, Maron, you know, has admitted that he's starting to trust himself enough that he really does, like, you know, I'm going to go to the Comedy Store, I'm going to work this out. And you find the lines and you find the beats. Whereas before, he would have to write a lot more ahead of time, right? And Chappelle, you know, I think, you know, this is where the 10,000 hours comes in. Like, when you have done it long enough and you learn to trust your instincts, and, you know, clearly I am not a person that's, you know, one gazillionth of whatever they are, but I have experienced that, you know, whatever you want to call it, flow, that it just comes from you, and, like, the laughs come, and you... Somebody said, I love when you said X, and you go, I don't remember saying X, right? Yeah. So when you do it as much as they have and as well as they have, that probably comes easier and easier and easier, right?
Yeah. My buddy Rob Cleveland did stand-up in Atlanta, well, all over the country for years. He's also an actor and a storyteller. And he talked to, you know, I asked him, what was your best experience and worst experience as a comedian? His best experience was when he started working a crowd and he got that flow.
Right.
And he said, I just went with the room at that point. He was standing on tables, talking to audience members, engaging. You know, it's that trust that you can throw something at an audience member and they're so enamored with what you're doing that they're not there to heckle. They're not there to throw a curveball at you. They want to feed you.
Right.
And you feed them back.
Right.
He said, I felt like Richard Pryor for a night, which I think if any comedian could feel like Richard Pryor for a night, you know, 1979 Richard Pryor.
Right.
Home run.
Yeah, I don't think I ever felt like Richard Pryor. I'm trying to think if there's an analogy in there somewhere. Like, my best night ever. Because, like, the most people I ever performed in front of was, like, not my best night ever. Like, I remember I got this gig in Vegas, and I don't know how many seats it was, but it was a lot. And I remember, like, the lights are in your eyes, so you can't really tell. And I think I didn't want to look before because I would have been too scared. And I just remember hearing the first laugh, and it was, like, it kind of, like, overwhelmed me.
Yeah.
And then I was so nervous, I didn't know what to do the rest of the time. Like, I wasn't, you know what I'm saying? So it wasn't even my best show. But we have to back up a little bit, because we're 18 minutes in. I have yet to ask you anything personally about... But if you listen to my show, I don't know, have you listened to my show ever?
I listened to your show. You had my buddy Lucky Yates on recently, and Mike Panuski, and lots
of... I love Mike. Mike is great. Lucky was weird, because I just kind of didn't know where that was going to go.
Nobody knows where Lucky's going to go.
Yeah, fascinating dude, that Lucky Yates. And really loud. A really loud person.
I guess so.
We were in a conference room. He was very loud. Mike, I want to have Mike back on. I think Mike's great. Anyway, what town did you grow up in?
Grew up in Decatur.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I don't even think I knew that about you.
Yeah. Born in Nashville. My family moved here when I was one.
Okay.
So
you've been in Atlanta the rest of the time.
I am the saddest homebody you'll ever find.
That's
traveled the world.
That's not true. You are not the saddest homebody. And when you were a young man in high school, what did you want to be when you grew up?
This is a delightful paradox, because you've experienced both, so you'll appreciate this. I wanted to be a stand-up comedian,
okay,
but I knew that was a one in a million shot and a really rocky road. So I decided I wanted to be a radio DJ, which I quickly found out when I went into radio, I might as well have gone into comedy or acting, because it was the most unstable environment I had ever seen.
Okay, so what did you go to college?
Yeah, went to Mercer, Atlanta.
Okay.
Is
that still around?
It's still around, but in a very different form. When I went there, actually right up until I walked into there to meet my counselor, I was going to be a religion major.
Okay.
And I met my counselor, who was a religion teacher, and walked out, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to major in communications.
It was that quick?
It was that quick. Well, I knew... In the back of my mind, I just needed somebody to trigger it, and I was like, yeah, this isn't me.
Right.
It's
just me. By the way, I thought I heard a buzz.
I don't know.
We're good.
Okay. So I got a degree in communications, which was broadcasting and theater. It was the whole shebang. And then worked at a radio station for about a year, year and a half, treading water.
Which one?
It's not around anymore. It was WCNN, which is the AM station, which at the time did news, but it wasn't affiliated with CNN. It was just in the same building. And then they started an FM station called WALR, which stood for Atlanta's Light Rock, which quickly became known as Atlanta's Lowest Ratings. I was on from midnight to 5:30 and had higher ratings than our morning man that we hired away from another market. And that's not a credit to me. That's how poorly the radio station was doing.
What is your radio name?
Tommy Houseworth.
Okay.
I didn't have, I wasn't clever enough to come up with anything, which I got my first stalker and had my first little sense of like, oh, people don't care who you are. They don't even know what I look like. But yeah, a woman would call the radio station looking for me if I happened to not be on the air that weekend, and finally got my home number. And I'm like, wait a minute. So that was odd.
And you played, so what were you playing? Like light rock? What were you playing?
I guess on the...
Gail, what's his name? Gail Sears?
This is 1989, 1990. So on the upswing of this was your Don Henley, your Billy Joel. The downswing was Wilson Phillips and Milli Vanilli.
Got it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So you did that for a year?
Did that for like a year and a half. And then the station went under. And I started grad school at Georgia State studying playwriting, which my family at that point was just like, you just can't pick a career that pays more than $6,000 a year, can you?
Right. Playwriting. Who knows you could even major in that?
Well, it was a theater major. The concentration was playwriting.
Right. Did you work along this time?
Yeah, I worked at the school. I paid for my tuition by being a teaching assistant there, and then I taught at the Alliance Theater. They started improv classes, and almost immediately the person... teaching the improv class had to move to North Carolina because there was work there as an actor. And I had taken like two improv classes and had started doing workshops with Laughing Matters in town. And they're like, you're the most qualified we can find. Can you teach improv? So I was so enamored with improv at the time. And it was before it had become the phenomenon that it became. And then I'm probably going to have some improv friends yell at me for this, but sort of the cliche that it's now, it can be a punchline.
Right.
At times.
Right.
Because I guess there's just so much bad improv out there. But when it's done well and it's done right,
it's phenomenal.
It's phenomenal.
Right.
So I taught improv. And while I was at the Alliance, the woman who was working as like the student counselor there, when people would call and be like, I want to take a class, was just starting her company, which was designed to bring theater to the business world. So hiring actors who were underemployed and taking them to companies who were looking for people to do, you know, something outside of just showing a training video or something, like bring actors in and have them play scenarios or hire them to do a murder mystery or whatever. So I got involved with that from the ground up. We eventually became business partners. I started doing corporate improv, which sounds like a horrible thing, but I have some nightmare stories. If anybody would read the book, I'd happily write it about some of the gigs we had. But we did that for, I don't know, 15 or 20 years.
What?
I mean, periodically. It wasn't like a weekly thing.
That's a long time.
That's a long time to, yes.
That's a really long... Wait a minute. Haven't you written a few books?
I've written three. The first one I don't talk about that much, because if I went back and had somebody edit it, it might have been okay.
Okay.
But then the next two, I'm still pretty proud of. Short story collections.
Okay. They available on Amazon?
Yes, available on Amazon.
Okay. I will link them.
Welcome to Storyville. Came out in 2006-ish. And Buddhist Catnaps came out in 2014.
That's recent.
That's fairly recent.
That's like maybe as long as I've known you. Did I know you when that book came out?
Not quite.
What is Buddhist Catnaps?
That's a line from a Kurt Vonnegut book.
Well, aren't you fucking fancy?
He said that he thought short stories were like little Buddhist catnaps because you can sort of get lost in them and get meditative with a story for a couple hours, and then it's over, as opposed to a novel. And I've never had the attention span, as Raymond Carver said, to devote myself to a novel. So short stories were always sort of my sweet spot.
But you're like, when you're getting paid to do this, like day in, day out, are you like looking for other work? Are you hoping to do something else? Like when you start getting paid to do improv comedy, corporate improv.
I guess the nice thing about what my company provided, my partner left in 2002. It was our company, and we could kind of do what we wanted with it as long as corporate America said, yeah, we want to hire you for that. So I started doing more what they called corporate theater, like Second City style sketch comedy that addressed, like, you know, if Home Depot is having a problem with people showing up to work late or whatever, like, okay, we'll do some sketches about how important it is to be at work on time and how it affects everyone.
You perform these live for the...
Live for who, you know, there's...
In conference rooms?
No, typically in ballrooms. I mean, that was the amazing thing
okay,
about
so
it.
Okay, like, so like at the Marriott Marquis?
Yeah, or at their annual convention in Las Vegas or, you know, Laguna
What's
Beach.
What's the name of your company or was it?
Seven Course Communications. I hate the name, but I had to keep it... My partner Pam had named it Seven Course Theater because it was going to be dinner theater for corporations. We quickly got away from dinner theater for all the reasons that anybody would.
Absolutely.
And at that point, we sort of had at least enough of a name that we're like, well, if we change our name, it might just sink us because people at least know who we are. So when she left, I changed it from theater to communications because I was doing more writing. So my goal became... keep doing the improv and that kind of stuff as much as I needed to, but I really wanted to move into writing scripts for like corporate videos, speeches.
But
whatever.
Can you gotta explain this to me because I'm fascinated, as I'm sure our audience is.
Oh, I bet.
This is all.
We were talking about Dave Chappelle 10 minutes ago. This now it's Home Depot
boring.
Training.
It's boring as fuck now. It's boring AF. This is pre-internet. This is pre-social. Like, how the fuck are you getting consistent work this way? This is what's fascinating to me.
Apparently, relationships used to work.
That was a good involuntary laugh.
I mean, you do. You
sit. Were you in the phone book pitch. Under something?
Yeah, we
were under comedy.
We were in the phone book under everything from theater, which led to a lot of confusion. Like, can I? You know, what show are you doing this week? It's like that's not how we work.
Right.
To corporate events,
right?
Meeting planners,
right?
Now I'm only place I list is in the Georgia Film and Video Guide,
right?
Because we're the only company that I know of that lists ourselves as like we write stories, scripts, speeches, etc. for corporate America, because everybody in Atlanta right now is making film,
right?
As they should be.
What about the ACVB?
Done a lot of work with them. We used to be a member of them, but the fact that I'm located in Decatur and it's the Atlanta, you know, Convention Visitor Bureau. I know, but it's
you're
just
not
like,
in Kennesaw.
I'm not in Kennesaw.
And I'm sure there's plenty of like lighting companies that are in Kennesaw.
There are, but I mean, just to be honest, my interest in...
Don't you love how we're so snotty we're shitting on Kennesaw?
That's where my son lives now. Thank you. So
he's a student. It doesn't count.
That's true. His mail still comes to our house.
Listen, 30144. I was there for a time. Let's call it 94 to 95, maybe 92 to 95. So mm-hmm. Still got a little love for
sure.
Town. What is that? What's that town like? Parkway. What is that called? Town.
I don't know. I just remember everybody used to was required by law to own a gun.
Right.
Which I was like, oh gosh.
That exit. What's that exit? Not Chastain Road, the one before to the one after it.
I haven't been out to visit.
I know, dude,
obviously.
But like, there's a huge mall there. It became a thing when I lived there. That was like one tiny little strip, and I worked. The Office Depot opened, and I worked there. Wow. And so we were there for something the other day. I forget what. Taking my son to a birthday party, and I drove by, and I was like, Jackson, I used to work there. So anyway,
like, no way, Dad.
Exactly.
So basically, to come back around, what I recognized was I was hiring, you know, fellow improv actors to go out and do a show that may or may not be like the most fulfilling thing in the world for them. Maybe it paid for some bills or something, but I was enjoying the writing aspect more. So I focused my energy on writing and now, you know, don't really pursue the improv stuff.
Right. But back then, so in your 20s,
yeah.
Were you like, this is eventually going to lead to a gig on Saturday Night Live? Like, what were your goals?
I mean, when I went to have my headshot done for, you know, for acting gigs, I remember the headshot photographer asking me, he said, I want you to tell me what your dream job is, because that's what you should be doing here.
Right.
And I said, I would like to be a regular on Saturday Night Live.
A regular or a writer?
No, at the time, you know, it was, when you're in your 20s, you're like, I'm going to throw every quasi-talent I think I have against the wall and see what sticks. And if... I was really pursuant of acting at the time and went from being that guy who just wasn't polished enough to being the guy who always got the call back but then always lost to the same two or three guys.
Right.
And that was also sort of a decision-making thing for me to like, okay, I feel like I know what I'm doing as a writer. I want to get better at that because as an actor, I'm really good sort of as the Conan O'Brien-like host. But there's not necessarily a lot of call for that in film and commercial, It's more like corporate gigs. Again, would you host our show? Would you be our MC?
Which, so what are the characteristics or adjectives you would use to describe the Conan-like host?
Despite what my wife would say, a good listener. Because apparently I am on job sites, but at home sometimes not. I think a natural ability to take material that exists, apply it to your specific audience. Again, I can't do the same material in front of, you know, IBM that you're going to do in front of Home Depot, because you need to tailor the material to your audience. So it's being able to come up with fresh stuff, and also corporate gigs no different from, you know, the real talk show world, and that expect about 25 curveballs that you've got to react to pretty much in the final rehearsal that are going to change everything you thought you were going to do. So that ability to be nimble, and surprisingly, what got me is the ability to be appropriate in front of a corporate audience, because there were some people, if I wasn't going to do a gig, you know, they're like, oh, we'd like to have you host this thing. I'm like, I'm not available. I got to think about who I'd recommend for this, because you know what? I can't recommend him or her because I can't trust them on stage, which is a horrible feeling, but it's true. I mean, there are some comedians who are just not born to... I will say this. I love Lucky Yates. He toured the country with us doing improv.
Right.
For one company. They took us to like 6 different cities. He was phenomenal, knocked it out of the park.
Right.
But I know he has said to me before, he's like, corporate ain't my bag, baby. And now I wouldn't want to hamstring him.
That's a good
one. It's like, okay, you're going to get paid less than you get paid on Archer. And Archer you can do in your pajamas at home and call it in. So
let's pause.
Here comes Stacy.
To say hi to Stacy Davis.
Hey there.
Hi. Hey Stacy, this is Tommy.
I'm Tommy.
Hi, Tommy.
And I know you
nice
from
to meet
Facebook
you.
And from Matt. Okay. At least I see you, so it's good to meet you.
Good to meet you too.
Have a good day at work.
Thank you.
That was a good Lucky impression. But when you say that, like, did you have someone that you worked with and you go, listen, just so you know, like, this is corporate, you gotta be super clean.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And they were like, okay, I'll do it, and then they didn't, and then that's why you say you can't trust them, or you just know they wouldn't even want to try?
My greatest weakness as an improv director when I first started was I was just unwilling to, I guess it's a strength in improv, I always say yes. I was unwilling to say no to people who weren't ready to be up there yet. So sometimes people, just because I wanted to be nice, I'd put them on stage before they were ready. Now, Tommy Futch at Laughing Matters would do that, but he'd do it in some dive to, you know, make you hone your skills by getting up and bombing so that you go, okay, don't do that again.
Right.
We had a couple of corporate, like, work showcases.
Right.
Where clients were invited, we rented out a space, and, you know, one night we knock it out of the park. Well, the next night, half the audience is from Chick-fil-A. And one of the young actresses on stage, first words out of her mouth were, God damn it. And I was like, okay, see, we just lost the Chick-fil-A business.
Right.
Which at the time would have been quite welcome. So...
Not even motherfucker, just God damn it.
Well, that's a big one there.
I know, but that's tough. Ooh, that's
so
tough.
You know, I think that was the biggest obstacle we had to overcome doing improv for corporate, was people didn't trust us. And it wasn't because they didn't believe that we had the best people in terms of...
My wife is going to realize any moment that she has to move this car first.
Oops.
Sorry. I would usually do that for her.
Sorry, dear.
Or do I have the keys? Just moved inside the house. Matt has air conditioning. So here's what I know about you, Tommy, right? And I don't know you going back all these years, but here's what you seem to have that many of us, I'm pointing at my own self, were missing. Artistic ability is over here. Over here is something called business sense. Mm. Or what's another word for it?
I don't know that it's business. I know what you're saying. I mean, it's an awareness that... Like, for example, my 2 collections of short stories are just from the gut, from the heart stories that I wanted to tell.
Right.
They have some language. They have some questionable things that might bother people of certain faiths or whatever.
Right.
I don't mean they're like ugly. I just mean like, you know, okay, I'm a Buddhist. I write from that perspective. If I'm not going to call Chick-fil-A and say, I want to drop by 100 copies of my book, you're going to question why I talk about the Dalai Lama so much. So given that, I try to keep those things separate. There's the purely artistic stuff I do just for myself, and it goes wherever it goes, which is usually not very far, but it's still satisfying. And then there's the corporate work, which I put myself in my parents' shoes, who saw me, who are in no way artistic people. That's not a criticism. They just don't come from that world. I was an anomaly to them. They're like, why do you not want to go get a job at AT&T and just stay there for 40 years and you'll get a watch and a pension? And
right.
That's the world they came from.
Right.
That was foreign to me. But when I discovered, hey, some of what I love to do can be done for this audience, they really love it because their day-to-day life can kind of suck sometimes. You know, you're going out and selling pharmaceuticals or wrenches or whatever. And, you know, to actually have a 3 or 4 day event in Palm Springs and we brought out this comedy troupe or whatever and here, laugh, hopefully. And then sometimes they're pissed because it's like, we've never heard of these people.
Right.
Why didn't you spring, you know, $50,000 and get, you know, whoever.
Where's Bill Shatner?
Right, exactly. So, yeah, Bill Shatner's who I would think would replace us perfectly.
I say Bill Shatner because I had a company, or so, you know, I told you that, you know, I'm semi in that convention world. I used to staff conventions. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of them had Bill Shatner as like the, like sort of the host. And I remember thinking like, what did they have to give him? Because it wasn't Dreamforce. It wasn't like the biggest convention in the world. It was some Microsoft thing in Florida. Yeah. And I was like, is he just the kind of guy that's like, it's 50 grand for one day, I'll fly. You know what I mean? Because he's like, has to pretend he gives a shit. Like, I heard him say a couple of lines. He did the work. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, most of what I write ends up getting said by actors nobody's heard of or executives. And executives, it's safe. If they approved it, then you've already won because right. The audience is just going to respond as they would respond to that executive. But the few times that I've gotten to write for others, like I got to write like an opening bit for Penn and Teller in Las Vegas, which
Dude.
Was, no, it made me so happy. And I was so scared because I was like, this really has to be good because this is being funneled through, you know, quasi-legendary magicians and comedians here.
Right.
Honestly, I mean, they were great, but they were also like, hey, nobody is going to see this except Auto Trader. So we will get up and say, as long as it doesn't go against our principles, we'll say whatever you want and we'll make it as funny as we can. I mean, they weren't saying your material sucks or that it's great. They're just like, no, we'll say whatever's on the prompter. We'll make it work. So it was kind of like, okay, as opposed to
Penwood.
Penwood, yeah. Teller.
Because Teller
was mum was the word with him. And Jeff Foxworthy. I wrote a show that he emceed. And
I would be so much more nervous for Penn and Teller than Jeff Foxworthy.
Oh, yeah, because Foxworthy... Well, the nice thing, Rob Cleveland, who I mentioned, was on the show. And Rob and Jeff knew each other. And they hung out backstage and had a great time because they came up at the same time in the comedy world in Atlanta. So I could just tell how amenable Jeff Foxworthy was. I was like, He wants to get out there and make people happy and do a good job, but he's also not going to be like, I'm sorry, this line doesn't work. Can we change that?
Right.
He was like, I'll say what you've asked me to say because you're paying me well to say it.
I had one experience with Jeff and it was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw Blue Collar Comedy Tour in LA.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Tom Ryan knows most of those guys going way back. And so we saw that show and... At the time, they had this guy, Reno, opening, and Reno ended up doing... Do you know Reno Collier?
I know the name.
So he went on to do, like, the junior version of that Blue Collar Comedy Tour, and mm-hmm. he's made a few bucks himself. Like, maybe him and Larry went out on tour, the cable guy, whatever.
Right.
But he said that Foxworthy... They were out on this tour, and Reno was, like, the opening act or whatever, and he said that Foxworthy, like, he got a gig once... And Foxworthy was like, yeah, like, we'll give you the jet to like fly back and do your gig and come back. And,
nice.
You know, right? That's, you got money. Nice to help people, right?
Comedians are pretty cutthroat. So
well,
that's...
clearly he wasn't. But dude, so like, I'm dying to know like what you had to write about for, like, because they have a very particular style. And like, did you think you needed to involve magic somehow? Like, how did you do that?
Well, in that particular case, they
did
were...
Did you make an Auto Trader disappear?
They were opening up a Auto Trader awards show.
Right.
So they did some of their own shtick and then they went into the Auto Trader specific humor. So there were some jokes about, you know, again, it's the safe zones of some of the executives, some of the people that the audience is going to be like, hey, you made fun of Alan, that kind of thing. But also we had the good fortune of Auto Trader had this, I don't know, it was like this freaking rabbit puppet that some guy who used to be in the world of showbiz, like Controlled, that worked there, and it had been in a lot of their videos and was kind of this little quasi mascot celebrity. So they did a whole bit about, you know, magic with a rabbit, making it come out of a hat. Right. So it was kind of organic.
So if Auto Trader comes to you or whomever,
yeah,
because we don't want to risk
single them out.
And we don't want to make you liable for whoever knows who could be listening. Do you ask for the notes? Who's going to be okay? Can we poke fun at so and so? Like, who's okay to do it?
There's
and
a
they
whole-
go, oh, you got to make fun of Bob. But like I'm saying, like, the higher up the better in terms of poking fun at, but mm-hmm. like, he's got to be cool with it.
Right. There's a whole vetting process that goes on.
Okay.
And everything, as you know, in corporate world is done by committee. So
17 people.
Right. Typically, what happens is, you know, I sit down in a room with three or four people. They're like, oh, you know what would be great is if we got Roger. And we joked about Roger's divorce, you know, something where you just go, oh, my God, no. But whatever they latch onto, eventually it goes sort of up the chain. And if it passes a certain place, or sometimes they'll even go to Roger and be like, hey, Roger, we kind of wanted to joke about how you're single now. And Roger's like, yeah, I don't care. So you sort of have to vet it because, yeah, the worst thing that can happen is if everybody in the room, you just feel the air go out of the room.
You've got to tell me about a couple of those experiences, though, like just the ass puckering experiences.
Oh, God. Well, I told you one with Chick-fil-A. I mean, there have been so many wrong turns that happened, some that you can't control. Like, we did, our improv troupe was supposed to perform at this huge event, corporate event. There were like, I want to say 8,000 or 9,000 people there, which is the wrong environment for improv. Improv should be intimate,
right,
and a controlled environment.
No one from the back can see what you're doing.
Right. So they started the night off, much to our chagrin, by saying, tell you what, everybody, the DJ's here. We're going to dance for a while.
Right.
Then they hand me the microphone, right, and they're like, okay, it's your show.
Right.
I'm like, so I have to tell everybody to stop
dancing.
Fun. So right out of the gate, and again, improv, we can control what happens on stage.
Right.
And typically in the 90s, when it was still new to everybody, we would say, okay, we're going to be coming to you for suggestions for the night. You don't have to be creative with it. Just
throw it out.
However, remember that here at Young Life Ministries, there are certain things that we don't joke, you know.
Right.
So we set the parameters PG-13.
Right.
So the first question, I'm like, name something you might do on the weekend.
Right.
Guy in the audience is like, get a blowjob. The rest of 9,000 people go silent. I'm like, anybody else? Because we can't do right. that on stage
right.
and get the paycheck.
Right.
Nothing.
Wow.
Luckily, because again,
can you pretend you heard something? Like, okay, I heard go to the grocery store.
Well, again, because improv actors and the people I was relying on and our troupe know how to take something suggestive and turn it.
Right.
Blowjob, sorry, Mom, turned into a guy who blows up balloon animals.
Okay.
A job
right.
blowing balloons.
Right.
I'm doing Jerry Seinfeld. but we got about 30 seconds into that, and the audience is, you know, huh? And all of a sudden, next door, there's a corporate event in this big-ass place. The Charlie Daniels Band was performing. They started playing and blew out our entire sound system. I don't know what... I mean, I wasn't responsible for the sound
thank
system.
Thank you, good night.
But they couldn't even hear us. At that point, it was just Devil Went Down to Georgia next door. So we walk off stage. You know, I'm talking to the client. The client's first words weren't, let's get this whole Charlie Daniels thing fixed. She's like, I can't believe you took blowjob as a suggestion.
Oh, my God.
There was only so much we tried to get any of the other 8,022 right. people in the room to say something.
Right.
But you trust us that we're not going to get on stage and act out something obscene.
Right. Right.
And I'll say 97% of the time that was the case when doing corporate improv is right. whatever we had thrown at us, we would just turn. And the audience does appreciate you taking something that puts you in a straitjacket and seeing how you get out of it.
Right.
That's what they've always loved about improv. And I think that's why it gets picked on a little bit now, is just because it's so prevalent that it's like people are into some of the gags.
If you listen to like Marin talk about it, like comics always never like really like trusted the improv actor, like didn't quite know what was going on over there, thought maybe they weren't as cool, whatever. And as he's gotten older, he's appreciated because, like, yeah, you know how to work with somebody. And that was sort of what I was sort of kind of asking about.
Oh, yes.
With
yes.
you, with the original question about working well with others, because many of us, me included, and millions more, have this, like, you know, punk rock, do or die, you know, no one's going to buy me, man. I'm just going to be myself and yet be your broke ass self. And there's so much gray area between that and, you know, selling your soul to, you know, your corporate soul to whoever.
Well, I mean, for me, the selling of my soul would have been if I had just given up on wanting to create and been like, you know what, I'm just going to go take the 9-to-5 job and the pension and be that guy.
Right.
What it's allowed me to do is have an artistic life that is wholly artistic and getting to write short stories and whatever. And then this middle ground of taking the same creative sensibilities and applying them to some rules. I mean, short story writing and poetry writing has some rules. You just have to know how to break them. Same with writing a corporate video. I mean, okay, how do we break this rule so that this video is more fresh than the last one they had?
Right.
But if I had, so I get to have a foot in that world that has, I won't say stability, but I do know that if I were to go do an improv gig in a coffee house, whatever money's in the tip jar is what you get, or, you know, maybe the bar that you performed at will pay you.
Right.
But if you go perform for AT&T or Verizon or whoever, whichever mobile carrier you prefer, that, you know, in 30 to 45 days, a check will show up 99% of the time. So, and they value that because, I mean, what I found with particularly the script writing and things like hosting is all they have to do is try it once and go, yeah, we don't want to do this. This isn't our wheelhouse, or we don't enjoy it, or more than anything, we don't have time for it. We would rather pay somebody well to be creative on our behalf, and somebody who exists outside of our little biosphere so that you can see some things we don't. I think that that's beneficial as well.
So I have friends on the speaking circuit, motivational blah, blah, blah. They got a book to hawk. Maybe they got an online course to do, and they make anywhere from a decent living to a really good living. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a guy I know makes like 15 grand, like that's his rate, and he gets it a lot, and he does 100 dates a year or 300, whatever it is, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he's nobody that would anybody would any know is famous or whatever. Anyway, the point is, you know, it takes a while to get to his level. You know, he started at 3 grand, then 5, then 10, whatever it is. But anyway, for those people, my understanding of how they make money is, it's obviously relationships, and they're in 2 or 3 agencies that pass them around, and they get the phone calls, and they're kind of still always doing a little bit of hustling, but a lot of the gigs come to them. Is that how you get work, or at this point, are you 100% inbound, you're never looking for work, quote unquote? Even if you're a few weeks without a check, you're never looking for work.
If there is a quiet period, and I can almost pinpoint when it is, it's usually summertime when companies are like, you know, we're not doing a whole lot because people are on vacation and that kind of thing. I mean, thankfully, knock on something, I haven't ever, even during the recession, have to be like, okay, maybe that gig at Barnes & Noble would be helpful too.
Right.
But a good example, right after my business partner quit, this was shortly after 9/11, she was doing big Cirque du Soleil style stuff for corporate events. And her first thought was, people aren't going to pay 70 grand to have gymnasts hanging up on the ceiling when they're scared that we're about to enter into a deep, deep recession. So she was like, I'm going to find something else I want to do. I don't really love this anymore anyway. But for what I was doing, I could scale things down and be a writer and work from home and cast actors. And I had one company that was giving me like 80% of my work. They were just calling me all the time to be a creative director or a writer or a thinker or whatever. And I loved it. And all of a sudden I get a call one day from the owner who says, we're closing our doors. Never saw it coming because they were so busy.
Right.
But they made a few wrong turns, and he's like, so I think I owe you some money. If you can get here with the next hour and a half, I'll give you a check. If not, I'm moving on to my next vendor because we're liquidating. What scared me more than that was, you know, that was they were bringing in just constant work for me. Every person who left that business either went and worked for another company or started their own thing and took me with them. So exponentially, my business grew for the next 3 or 4 years. And that during that time, I made lots of contacts, both directly with companies, with production companies that do work, with agencies that hire outside people to come in and be creative. So it's this hybrid of things. My lesson from that is, one, don't depend on, like, don't put all my eggs in one basket again, because they may not explode in the same beautiful fireworky kind of way. Instead, stay involved with a lot of different companies. And then if one starts to peter out for some reason, there are other ones I can depend on. Can't say that I've had to look for a lot of work in a number of years. Every now and then when it gets a little too quiet, I will just, you know, I mean, social media is great for this, just, you know, staying in touch with people that way. But I haven't had to go on a massive marketing campaign, which is nice, because that I have seen people have to do that. And that's when you, when it finally hits, you're a little too far behind the eight ball to
usually.
Yeah. So I've been very fortunate. I'd like to think that, you know, it's a trust that's been well earned, because I've always worked very, very hard to make sure I make the people who hire me look good, and be very open in communication with where things are. And again, if I'm like, oh, I can't take this project, but instead of just letting you hire some random writer who I don't know and risk losing the work, I have these other couple of writers that I know and trust, and you can hire them through me, and I will supervise things. I'll be like the executive producer writer guy who touches the copy and looks at it before you get it to make sure you're happy.
But again, I think this is what a lot of people don't do. It's a lot of it seems to come to you very naturally.
Well, I learned through mistakes along the way, but and just watching other people. I mean, not all my own mistakes, but watching other people do it right and do it wrong.
Right.
I mean, if I went back the 25-ish years I've been doing this, it's like I could probably flag an awful lot of accidental mentors. People who taught me something and then moved on.
Right.
They didn't stay with me and coach me for years. They were just like, hey, don't forget this kid.
Right. Well, you know, so I want to ask you a lot of stuff selfishly, because mm-hmm. I have only recently decided that I could get paid from other people to write. I've mm-hmm. been writing for my own organization, as it were, mm-hmm. for 6 years or whatever. And I actually got to write a book, right?
Nice.
And also available on Amazon. And was in Barnes & Noble for a long time. I think they're finally gone. Like, basically, like, they put so many in the stores. If it gets bought quick enough, they put more in.
Right, otherwise, yeah.
I think I'm no longer.
Yeah.
It used to be no matter what city I was in, I would stop and I would find it and I would sign it and I would, hooray. Anyhow.
I would buy a couple just to, you know, like, hey, it's obviously in demand, and then put them back on the shelf. So, yeah.
I did not do that. But anyhow, so I would get a call from these editors, mm-hmm. Or actually it turns out it's just a writer, right? Just a guy. Hey, I got to write a thing on obstacle racing. They want to know the 7 best this, or can you give me a quote about that? And I would go, sure. And then I go, hey, well, by the way, if you ever need like somebody to write it, like, I'll do that. And that person would never call me back because they're on to writing the next gig.
Yeah.
It wasn't that they didn't like me.
Yeah.
So I finally have started to reach people with the word editor in their name. And so those people can hire me.
Right.
And, you know, something happened recently where, you know, my wife and I were talking about it, that I'm a much more mature person. And I know that I probably wouldn't have been ready for it before because, you know, the feedback I got was like this, this, and this. And I think my immediate reaction would have been like, well, fuck you. If you don't like it this way, this is how I write. You know what I mean? Instead of like, again, like, I'm not, you know, this is not going against my soul that you have this voice you want it to be in, right? Like,
yeah.
Certain editors are like, no, we want you to have your own voice. And some are like, no, it's got to fit the style that we're doing. And I'm like, sure. Like, who cares?
And I think that's another thing that is really important for what I've gotten to do is just as being on the, you know, being an MC or an interviewer or something, you have to be a good listener and knowledgeable enough about who you're talking to and what you're talking about. From the writer's point of view, you have to be willing to maintain your authenticity while you shed a little bit of your style or be a little bit of a chameleon.
Right.
So that, yeah, I, you know, this is a poor example, but you know, in some instances, you get to write like a really uplifting story that's designed to inspire an audience. And in other cases, it's like, here's the technical stats. We just want to make sure this audience knows we're not hitting our numbers, and here's right. what we need. And it's very dry, but you have to find a way to imbue it with a certain amount of energy and interest, but you can't make it wholly yours, because it's not yours to claim. It needs to sound like their brand and right. the way they talk.
Right.
It truly is like the Hemingway quote of, you know, kill your darlings. It's like, you just can't get attached to anything writing this kind of stuff.
Well,
it's not yours.
Killing your darlings for me is it's all about video editing. I've started making mm-hmm. those, like, you know, straight to camera videos, and or even a racing video, a straight up racing video. That to me is like, I've gotten way better at it. I mean, you know, my first video ever is like 7 minutes, and my friend Jeff's like, it's got to be 3 if you want people yep. to watch it, right?
Yep.
So that now, you know, sometimes you only have to kill 1 or 2 instead of 20. Like, that line works, but you know what? It gets to the point faster if I cut this. I just had that today when I made a video, and it was like, it took me 10 seconds to say, but you know what? It's an added thing that doesn't need to be there.
Well, the thing that has changed dramatically since I started writing stuff for corporate was, in the 90s, you could have an 8-minute corporate video and people would be like, oh, cool, it's a video.
Right.
And now I sat down with a client this week. They're like, so what are you thinking? They're like, and this is to be shown like on the internet. It doesn't matter if it's 60 seconds or right. 92 seconds, but they're like, we're really thinking 60-second broadcast is, that length is all we can hold an audience for. And I want to go, oh, no, but in my heart, I'm like, yeah, you're probably right.
Right.
So they get smaller and smaller, and the challenge becomes telling the story in that little nugget of time.
Right.
The fear is, like, if they get much shorter, they're not going to exist.
Right.
But I think, you know, everything, the pendulum swings, so we're going to get to a point where that nanosecond mindset is going to be like, okay, tell me a bigger story.
Supposedly, longer posts and longer videos do get more traction. So they say that, but in my experience, they don't. And I mean,
it depends what your goal is too.
I guess, but I'm saying that, like, for me, it seems to fit my, like, that fits my style
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah.
Talk fast. I you know, the, whatever you want to call it, that making that kind of video just suits my sense of humor. So it works for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
yeah.
so I want to do that more now. And I want to be a, you know, someone that creates that kind of content about yeah. other things besides just obstacle racing.
Mm-hmm.
I made a video with my kids. People loved it,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's like, okay, how can I fucking get paid for this?
How can I monetize my children?
Seriously, though. Because this is the question, dude, is that, like, because, like, you know, all cards on the table, I'm not making them, I'm like, I can afford where we live.
Yeah.
I'd like to be a little bit past that. I'd like to not just pay the bills, right? And I pay a lot of bills late often. So if my instinct was, if I sit down with my kids and have them try these drinks, I bet it'll be pretty funny. You know what I mean? And I was right. People were like, best thing you've ever done. And they don't say that for no reason. Someone might say good job or
no.
give you a little like. But if somebody says best thing you've ever done, they fucking mean it. Especially when they know I produce a lot of shit. So it's like, okay, I trusted that. I need to make more of these. But, like, am I going to start the Madness Kids channel? Probably not.
Maybe not. But, I'm, you know, there's... My wife watches these, they're like mommy bloggers or
right.
something, and they're hysterical.
Right.
And I'm sure they have found, and she's got, it's a woman who blogs. She just basically quit her life and converted a camper into a sleeper kind
right.
of thing, and just drives around the whole country just living.
Right.
And living outdoors, and, you know, she's monetized that by getting sponsors and getting people to...
Right.
So I can't tell you how to go out and find a sponsor. That's the fortunate thing about what I get to do, is that people come to me
right.
and say, we need help writing this.
Right.
I think if I had a vision for something, like, again, my short stories, those are published on demand books. It's like the publishing company's like, yeah, when people order one through our website or through Amazon, we'll print them up.
Right.
That way we don't waste any money, because guess what?
What's your cut of that?
Percentage. I don't know the percentage. It went from, you know, a 4-figure check the first few times to, like, I literally could not buy a cup of coffee with the last royalty check I got.
Right.
Because I'm not out marketing it, and if I don't, nobody else will, because
right.
I'm not being represented by a big publishing house.
Right.
But again, that was like, that was just the yin to the yang of, like, if I'm going to spend all of my energy churning out scripts for corporate videos and live stuff and things like that, and I'm not getting the satisfaction just as an artist then I want to do something that's an outlet.
Right. And you're not doing what people, those speaker guys do, which they call like back of the room. Here's my speech. Now here's my books at the back of the room.
Right.
You're not doing that because no one's hiring you to be that guy. You're getting paid for a task. You're not like, come right here and yeah. motivate
and,
us.
And in fact, you know, I mean, from a hosting point of view, I walk out on stage and it's like they've let a room full of owls loose. They're like, who? Again, there's the tier of like...
From Atlanta, Georgia, author of...
Buddhist cat naps.
Too many kittens took a shit on a Buddhist nap. Tommy Hudson.
Yeah, so they don't...
Thank you!
At that point, they're not like, oh, we got a name...
Thank you!
...comedian. Thank
Velcro
you.
America. I was trying to be the most generic.
I guess you're stuck with me. Yeah, in that case, they're not looking for a name.
Hey, guys, I know what you're thinking. That used to be every comic's opening line, right?
I know what you're thinking.
Do you remember that? Do you remember that in those days?
Yeah,
I know what you're thinking.
How did Peter O'Toole...
And Conan O'Brien have a baby? Right? Every comic's horrible
See,
first line.
I'm being self-deprecating. Love me. That's one of the hard things, too, I think, typically, for me doing corporate comedy, it was not do a set. It was like write a few jokes about them and who they are, easy laughs,
right,
and get on with interviewing their executives or something.
So one of the biggest checks I ever got,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if I told you the story, I quit stand-up, mm-hmm. done doing stand-up. I'd started the staffing company. I'm doing that. I'm perfectly happy. Not perfectly happy. The business is struggling, but like I don't want to do stand-up anymore.
Yeah.
Somebody refers me to this lady. I couldn't remember who. And she was like, hey, I heard you're a comic. We're having a Christmas party. Would you come and like, we're hiring this guy to play games. You probably know this guy. I think I asked you if you knew him, the games guy.
I don't know.
I'm sure you know this guy.
Okay.
So we'll talk about him later. Basically, he would play whatever version of whatever popular game. When Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was popular, he would host a version of that. When, what were the other game shows that were popular, like Weakest Link.
Yeah, Weakest Link.
Whatever.
Do you Millionaire.
Text
yeah.
Quickly?
Yeah, I do.
It's okay. So he was part of it, and then they hired me to like sort of MC it, and uh-huh. they go, you know, we've got a budget of $500, and I was like, sure, right? Like pretty easy for me to do, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
2 weeks later, she calls me. We have this gig. It's all day, and it's for AT&T,
mm-hmm.
and I was just like, I don't really want to do it. I was like, $3,000. She's like, okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, motherfucker.
Oh, that's.
I've never seen $3,000 in my life as a comic. Do you understand?
Yes.
That for an entire weekend, six sets, I maybe saw $750 or $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I was like, and it was that whole like spiritual principles, which I did want to get to with you because I know you're a spiritual cat, of like not caring. Right? And then I thought, well, shit, I could do this. And all I had to do, they said, can you do, you know, you're going to introduce all the acts, but then once in a while, you're going to do trivia. And it was funny because even then, again, this is the old me. She's like, we're going to do trivia, but send us the questions in advance. Now, the me today would be like, absolutely. Back then, I was like, fuck them.
Yeah, man.
They're going to...
My questions are going to be so underground. Who is G.G. Allen?
They're not going to like them. And blah, blah, you know what I'm saying? I think I did everything I could to like not send them the questions, which
yeah.
is so stupid. But again, like, and this is not long... This is 7 years ago when I first got back, but I had the mentality of like, I wasn't sure how they were going to let me be like somewhat subversive with AT&T humor, which it wasn't. I was not Bill Hicks setting the world on fire with AT&T jokes.
No, but there's a certain integrity that I respect that artists have that I, you know, if this is selling out, I guess I did it so long ago that I don't remember where that line was. But we had a gig where
you've been swimming in millions so long that you don't know. In your backstroke
millions and millions. So we had a gig for a number of years where a company hired us to basically do fake job interviews. We would come in as job candidates. They would practice interviewing us as if we were really applying for this
job. So this isn't on stage. This is just in a conference room.
This is in conference rooms. And they would fly us all over the country. And the idea was for us to exhibit. It wasn't like, okay, you're secretly an alcoholic and it comes out during the interview.
Yeah.
It was like, you should be the best five people for this job. And they've got to discern behaviors. And they've got to listen. And it was really a good program. But
this I just saw it up in the air again. This is like a reverse up in the air.
Totally.
Almost, right?
Yes. And I was not George Clooney. So
none of us are.
None of us are. So one of the actors that was on this gig with us was a pure heart artist. He believes in the integrity of Picasso and Joe Strummer, and you don't question your commitment to the craft and the result. So him having to do a corporate gig already was tough on him.
Right.
But I remember the you know, the client saying, well, the reason we hired actors for this is because you're so good at lying. You lie for a living. And he goes, acting isn't lying. Acting is telling the truth. And walked out of the room. And I was like, well, we'll be replacing him. Right. And to an extent, I did want to say, well, technically actors don't lie. They play characters that reveal truths. But everybody in the room is in on the make-believe.
Right.
That's part of the fun.
Right.
So for him to say that, I was like, okay, you don't get what we do. But at the same time, what we're doing isn't, we're not doing Death of a Salesman. We're doing how to hire a fucking salesman.
Don't you remember that classic scene from Tootsie?
Yeah.
Right? What's the line? I was a fucking tomato.
Yeah, I was a juicy, ripe beefsteak tomato. I played a whole group of vegetables on Broadway, George.
And was Pollock his agent?
Yes, which
Pollock is the best. Dude.
Pollock is great, and they really had that tension between them, which is what I love. Like Pollock found, as the director, found Dustin Hoffman the most frustrating,
really,
because he was so committed to his method.
I just saw. Speaking of Clooney, I just saw. Man, all Clooney's movies run together. Michael Clayton again.
Oh yeah,
and he's got. That's kind of like his kind of stereotype. Character Mike Pollock there towards the end of his life, just that guy,
kind
of gruff, no bullshit guy.
He was in Crimes and Misdemeanors, Husbands and Wives.
Husbands and Woody Wives. And,
yeah.
Anyway, so everybody said the same thing. Everybody said, "Well, yeah, because you didn't care, and that's why you got the job. You just threw the figure out there. You had no attachment to it." So I've been trying to replicate that moment for 7 years now, Tommy, and it's not been happening.
Well, it's because then you were aware you didn't care, and now you care. You're like, okay. I mean. I don't get to do this on a regular basis, but I'm hired by people who do, who are in charge of like, okay, the client wants, a band for the closing night. Brad Paisley costs this much, Dave Matthews band costs this much. Radio.
Should we get? They ask you?
Well, they don't ask me. I'm just like in the meetings when it's happening and they're discussing it, or I'm, I just happen to be on the periphery.
Right.
But someone told me once, they said, the only two artists they had heard of that just absolutely wouldn't do a corporate gig were Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and Pearl Jam. I know since then Pearl Jam has done a corporate gig.
Right.
So I think the way that happens.
What about Bruce?
I asked. I was like, Bruce, you too? They're like, as far as I know, they'll do them. But they ask for so much money that it just becomes like, no way.
Right.
If you say, we're Apple Computers and we want, Bruce Springsteen to play this gig. He's like, well, he wants $17 million. Like, is Mellencamp available? Yeah. He wants $100,000.
Is he available?
Yes, but he's going to sit on a stool the whole time.
Go further down the line. Who's below
Seeger? Oh, gosh. That's all that asphalt rock trio there. I don't know who else has the gruff voice and the everyman quality.
I think we bottomed out.
See, I put Seeger ahead of Mellencamp.
You put Seeger ahead of Mellencamp?
Yeah. That's Mellencamp calling and he's pissed.
old Johnny Cougar. I recently just today got an email for a job that I was supposed to get a while ago. They finally sent it and the guy's leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if there's ever time to ask for a raise,
because
he's leaving anyway, he might not get
it. He'll bump it up and walk out the door.
I go, hey, how about a parting gift? Can you bump it to this? And I put a little winky face, which was maybe not the best tactic. I don't know. But he just said, nope, we're sticking to it. But I did ask, and I think that's even confidence growing for me, that in the past I wouldn't have even asked. And now it's like somebody said, look, it's just a chess game. It's just who blinks first. You throw the number out, and they say no. Okay, I'll do it for this much.
It's a chess game, and it's knowing the relation. Like, you knew you could winky face that guy.
Right.
There are clients who, when I have tried to negotiate how much, and that's another thing. I've had relationships with most of the people I'm working with now that we don't even really discuss money until after I've started the job.
Right.
Because it's typically like this meeting I went to this week. It was like we walked in. And I was like, wow, they want a script next week.
Right.
So they need me to write this, and I'm not going to hold them hostage.
Right.
But at the same time,
because they're going to come through.
Right. They're going to come through, and I'm not going to be jerking them around on my rate or anything like that. But at the same time, it's like there are situations where I've spent as much time crafting an email to ask about a budget as I have the first draft of the first page of a script, because I want to say it in a way that doesn't sound greedy, that doesn't sound weak, that sounds professional. And, you know, I guess probably one of my greatest flaws is that fear of losing a gig. You know, you're like, I don't want to piss them off, but at the same time, trusting, I've known these people, like, you could do that and know the guy wasn't going to be like, you know what, on my way out the door, I'm going to tell him Matt doesn't write for us anymore.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, we're solid. So I can ask. And if he says no, I'll wait till the new guy comes and, you know, ask again.
Right. That's why I was hoping to lock in the rates. The new guy, you know, had me at that rate and I could bump him again in a year or whatever.
Yeah.
Have you read any negotiating books? You seem like the kind of guy that would have.
It's funny. Like my This Is Your Last issue of Fast Copy showed up at the house this past week. And Wendy was, my wife was,
what's
like,
Fast Copy?
It's a business magazine. Fast Company, sorry. See, that's how little I...
What a fogey you are.
Oh, boy. Fast Copy, that was like a 90s, it was hard copy. So Fast Company, yes, sorry. Last edition of it shows up at the house, and Wendy was like, are you going to renew that? I said, I don't know. It's $10 for a year, and yet I haven't gotten my $10 worth. I mean, yes, I will sit down, and not because it's not a great magazine, just I don't spend the time with it. I think, as I put it to her, I was like, because the last thing I want to do when I clock out finally at the end of the day is sit down
business.
And read more business.
Right.
I know a lot of people who are younger and hungrier who do, and some of them might get ahead of me, and then I need to step up my game if that's the case. But for the most part, I kind of feel like my job is as much reading short stories and watching. I mean, that's one thing that I have been pleased about is my accountant was like, of course you can write off Netflix. That's what you do for a living.
Duh.
Yeah, but, you know, making sure. And it's like, yeah, I need to watch episodes of Breaking Bad and 30 Rock and Atlanta and those kinds of things because I need to know what works and what doesn't. So that, and particularly something like Atlanta more than 30 Rock, because 30 Rock is 10 right. years ago
I
at this
would,
point.
I think I've been away from stand-up for 10 years. I think I'd be horrible. I think it's the world has moved in a very different way and place. And I saw comics in my time that were stuck from the 80s that you could, like these older comics that you could tell like hadn't moved.
That is a big concern for me from a business sense, but more so from a creative sense. And it was a big wake up call for me like a few years ago, just recognizing that, you know, my wife pointed out, she's like, listen to a lot of old white guys. And I was like, yeah, I do. And now, like, I made my latest, like, you know, mix tape, as it were, my playlist. It's all mostly hip hop.
Right.
And that's not, oh, I'm trying to be hip. It's like, this is actually what speaks to me right now because of the current political climate and my son's age and what he's listening to. So, you know, while I'm not a musician, I've gotten to write two spoken word pieces in the past couple of months that are hip hop influenced, like a Hamilton kind of thing, for a client, and a spoken word piece that is supposed to weave in some messaging, you know, that kind of, and yeah, I would never ever like want Kendrick Lamar to see it, but at the same time, I'm getting to let that creative juice flow a little bit.
Let's do some hot takes.
Okay. Hot takes.
LinkedIn.
Spend a little time there, not as much as I should.
Facebook.
Spend way too much time there, more than I ever should.
Instagram.
Probably the best platform for me because you post a picture and you move on.
Twitter.
That's where I get most of my news now.
I think I've run out of, those are all the platforms.
Snapchat, where my kids go so I'll never find them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, so here's the thing, when you talk about that, because I try to do the separation of church and state, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm getting up from that thing.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the laptop is the distinction.
He's pointing at his laptop, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for that. For many people, like, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's all the same. To me, it's very different.
Yeah.
So it's, you and I are talking on text about something.
Yeah.
I'm making fun of you. You mentioned a book you want me to read. I'm like, can you email me that?
Because
then it's, the email is the to-do list, as it were.
Right.
So then when I'm just zoning out on, my wife is able to do that. My wife is not on social during the day.
Good for her.
So when she's done, that's her zoning out. For me, if I'm looking at Insta or Facebook and I see a product that I think is good for my audience, I gotta screenshot it, email it to myself so tomorrow I can email that company. Mm-hmm. So that's why social for me is so tricky, because I almost never turn. And then it'll start getting me thinking about like, oh, I want to go to that guy on LinkedIn. So I'm not working per se. I'm not going through emails or writing a blog, but I am in fact doing. Social isn't turning off for me.
You know, when I've told my wife I've wanted to leave social media, particularly Facebook, she's like, well, don't forget you've got clients on there, and that's a way you connect with them. And it's true. I don't ever be like, hey, I'm currently working on 3 scripts.
No, of course.
But just posting something funny and not controversial, lets them know, oh, yeah, you know what? I hadn't thought about Tommy for this.
Right.
Just staying connected in that way. So sometimes during the day that works. But what has been really a sure sign for me that I'm needing to get some more control over it is I will go on Facebook specifically for something like that. I'm going to send a note to Eric on Facebook about this funny thing I saw, and that'll remind him that I'm still out here. Or this is a big one. I'm my volunteer gig for the Shambhala Center where I do meditation.
Shambhala is
posting social media events and keeping people posted on what we're doing. And I'll go on there and start to log in and be like, I forgot why I'm here. Oh, look what Trump did. And down I go. Like
when I come home and CNN is on, if my wife has the TV on, I leave.
You have to leave, yeah.
But you are not someone posting content. You're not posting videos of yourself.
Mm-mm.
You're not doing a here's me for 30 seconds getting a laugh, or here's me with Obama. You're not doing any of that stuff.
No, well, he won't even return my calls anymore. But
someone in your position might, because they think, I need to do that.
I can be a pretty big meme monkey, but at the same time, the awareness I have gotten as I've gotten into writing and away from acting is this is so not about me, that the one place that I do sort of make myself known personally is through blogs, and I don't blog that often, but I mean, I do. If I post something on my blog that morning and share it on Facebook, I am checking it throughout the day to just like, did people like it, please? Because that's actually me.
Right.
And that means something to me, as opposed to,
right,
I want to make a client happy, but my heart is in the work, but my heart isn't dependent on that work in terms,
right,
of like, okay, I haven't bared my soul.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, social media is just, it's just a big, it's a cesspool and it's a healing stream all at once.
I think that's a nice way to put it. Which leads us to, you know, part of the podcast it is?
Karaoke?
Clearly you have not listened to
the show. I don't make it all the way through your show. I mean, I peter out.
You know, it's interesting because iTunes for the longest time wouldn't share analytics, and mm-hmm, they finally started sharing analytics, and it shows. I've never... Anybody that I listen to consistently, I listen to the whole show.
Yeah.
So when they kept showing like me like 56%, 76%, I'm like, who's listening halfway? Clearly you are.
It's
that
me.
Person.
And that's not you, just you. I do it to, you know.
No, I don't do it personally.
The
end of the podcast, mm-hmm, is the Atlanta Podcast Favorites Quiz.
Ah.
Okay.
Okay.
The first question is, what is your go-to order at the Waffle House, Tommy?
My go-to order at the Waffle House is hash browns and a pecan waffle.
Okay. What is your current favorite restaurant in Atlanta?
Chipani.
Okay, here's one I've never asked anybody. It just happened as we were sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
Which Atlanta the television show character are you? Just hit me.
Oh my gosh. I would like to think I am Earn, but I'm so not Earn. I'm not Paperboy.
Right.
And I've forgotten the other gentleman's name. Oh gosh.
None of us are that guy.
Yeah, none of us.
If anybody identifies with that guy, he's amazing.
I like to think that Earn's got a certain level of frustration and integrity trying to maintain that, around that. So that's I can relate to Earn the best. Let's put it that way.
Right. Okay, complete the sentence. I take Marta blank.
To the Atlanta United matches.
Okay. Rank these teams in importance to you. Braves, Falcons, Hawks, United.
United, Braves, Hawks, Falcons.
All right. Now, you are not a hipster millennial, but you are. You have gone all in on the United thing.
Yes.
Because?
Because we took the kids to a couple of matches last year and had the time of our life. So my wife was like, let's buy season tickets. And we did, and the kids stopped being interested almost immediately.
And where's been my invite? Wasn't an invite supposed to come to me?
Oh, yeah,
in the middle of deciphering my shitty
handwriting? It was at the end of my podcast. I don't guess you listened all the way. No, I'll be happy to take you to a match.
Okay. A match.
Yeah, that's what they call them.
On the pitch?
On the pitch. The match on the pitch.
Can you do a? Do you do a really horrible English accent?
I just did.
Do you do more?
I do. All of my accents end up sounding...
Racist?
Yeah.
Right.
No matter what I'm doing, it ends up sounding like Bad Asian.
Yeah.
Which is my other favorite restaurant, Bad Asian.
Bad Asian? That's a good spot. What other questions do I ask? That Atlanta thing just got me really excited.
Oh, good for you.
Because it's such a fun question. What else do I ask?
Oh, God. You know what? I just thought of it. If I'm any character from Atlanta, and I wish I weren't admitting this, I'm the guy in the Juneteenth episode that tries to appear so woke when he isn't. And I say that not because I'm not, but I don't think you get to give yourself that title. It's right. Like that needs to be given to you by an African-American, a person of color.
Right.
But that has been the thing since I started listening to hip hop is like, okay, everybody, see, I'm cool now, because right. I was never the cool guy.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the music thing, because I noticed that about my own self. I was going through what I had downloaded in Apple Music recently because I was looking for something, and it like just like guess this guy's age. Okay, if you go through what I listen to, and it's like it's Bruce, it's Billy Joel, mm-hmm. it's Elvis Costello, it's yeah. a lot of white dudes.
Yeah.
And because of my son, I'm very much re-fallen in love with hip-hop, which I did as a teenager in yeah. my early 20s, the Angry Young Man.
Yeah.
Great, great hip-hop, especially the Beasties, who kind of like, if you're my age, you grew up with them. Are we the same age? We discussed
I'm
this?
I'm 51.
Jesus, you're old.
I am.
46.
Okay.
So did you grow up with the Beasties? Because I really did.
I feel like
we aged with them as they got more mature.
Somewhere around Paul's Boutique, I think, is when... I did not dig You Gotta Fight for Your Right. That was not my vibe. But then they got more serious.
Right.
Bodhisattva Vow. I mean, I've got the lyrics
printed up. They are the Beatles of rap. I think that's very safe to say.
Yeah.
But anyway, so those are my kind of two... And I noticed even in recent years, like... Listening to Fox 97, that's not Fox 97.
Oh my.
Listening to The River.
Yeah.
Bob Seger didn't really speak to me before, and now it kind of does. You know what I mean?
Like, we age into some artists,
right?
I think. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Turn the page. Oh, that could be James Hetfield who does.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they.
Metallica covered it.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you follow much Metallica? Yeah.
Not really.
It's my Hetfield impression.
Yeah.
What's the best festival in Atlanta?
Oh gosh, as much as I love the book festival in Decatur, I'm gonna have to say the Decatur Arts Festival.
So gay, no. Two gay festivals in a row.
Did you want me to name like the Renaissance Festival? And
I mean, Decatur Book Festival. What was the other one?
Arts Festival.
Oh my goodness.
Am I supposed to pick Gladiators? What's gonna make you happy?
Of course, that's what you would say.
You mean the author who has been talking about being an artist for the last hour?
Tell me about your tattoo there.
Okay, so for everybody who's not able to see this, which I'm thinking is most of you.
I can take a picture.
I've got the word yes in typewriter font on my wrist with a period after the word yes.
Are you very specific? Aren't
very specific. I got it on my 49th birthday because my wife is a very adventurous person. And I am typically not, so she often sort of drags me kicking and screaming into expanding my world a little bit. I'm the Woody Allen character, and she's not Diane Keaton, I guess, but she's Meryl Streep in River Wild.
Okay.
Perfect combination there. Okay. So, I decided after...
Are you struggling with the lobsters?
One's getting behind the stove. So I decided...
Much better than your British accent.
Thank you, yeah.
And you're so not Jewish, too. You're so waspy.
I'm so waspy.
You fucking nailed that. Just why I think it's fucking
and you know,
so funny.
You know what went away in my stand-up act about 1993? Was my Woody Allen impression.
You ditched that.
Yeah, I had to kill that.
Right.
So I got the yes tattoo as a constant reminder to just say yes to more things. That I would typically be like, you know what, I need to get on home. You're getting the kayaks out? I'm sorry.
Right.
You know, I got to go home and not read a book.
Right.
So I can't say I've been batting 1,000 at it, but it's with me for the rest of my life to constantly remind me that I need to be open to more experiences that I feel like will expand my worldview.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right, so the last question is, by the way, we could talk much longer, but I didn't get my kids from school.
No. You take the kids.
Who should I have next on the Atlanta podcast?
Well, obviously Donald Glover would be a catch.
Absolutely. He's on the list.
I'm trying to think of somebody I know that I haven't already, like, kind of fed your way.
Oh, you have fed me a few.
Yeah.
You didn't give me Lucky, did you? No, somebody else gave me Lucky.
Somebody else gave you Lucky? I don't know who you... Did you have Gwen Hughes on the show? Pretty remarkable jazz singer in town.
I have not.
No, she's...
But I don't know if you introduced me yet either. Well, no, you know a few people, but I can't remember.
I mean, there's a lot of talented actors and writers in town. I'm hesitant to... I'll tell you what. Why not just the go-to, my best friend, a guy named Steve Coulter,
okay,
who's been in everything.
Okay.
One of those actors like Panooski who just keeps popping up in the past year. And this is a funny thing. He has to keep it under wraps when he's filming because you sign things to say.
Of course.
But he's like, I can't tell you who I'm with, but hoo-ha. I'm like, okay, you're filming with Pacino. In the past year,
It's more like hoo-ha.
There you go. You nailed that one.
Because she had a huge ass.
Yeah, that was the moment in Heat where I went, we lost Al. So, in the past couple of years, he's been in films with De Niro, Pacino, Robert Duvall. He's in all those horror movies that, there's the creepy music, and then all of a sudden something pops up in front of you. I've forgotten. The Conjuring, right. That whole series.
He's, right, yeah. I don't see any of those movies.
Okay. He is... made a sweet little living being just
I think we've been
character.
In contact and it's been okay. Like okay, next time in Atlanta we're going to talk, but I will now go out of my way to get him on the show.
I would highly recommend him. He's a good egg.
Alright, well, thanks for spending a couple hours with me.
Thanks for inviting me to spend a couple of hours with you. This has been fun.
Alright,
who knew we had so much to talk about.
There was Tommy and I from my house, from right here. Tom is a fascinating dude. Thanks so much for listening. As I said, I have got some great stuff lined up for you guys, so stay tuned for more of that. Be sure to tell friends about this podcast because that's how we can grow it the fastest, is when your friends say, hey, what are you listening to? You tell them, or before they even ask you, you just drop a quick text. Hey, have you checked out Atlanta Podcast yet? This guy talks to cool people. It's Atlanta-based, etc., etc. Hope you have a great, great week, everybody. I have got to run.